KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. And today, I have an insanely special guest. One, I don't even need to interview, or rather, I should interview, I should say that. One, I actually really don't need to introduce, and that's what I meant to say here. You can tell I'm a little freaked out and nervous. This is like meeting Santa. I was a kid at Christmas just before this interview. I'm not kidding. But with me today is Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. So, Dr. Tyson, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Dr. Neil to you.
Dr. Neil it is. All right, Dr. Neil. Fair enough.
Just Neil is fine. Plus, I'd like to contrast whatever you feel meeting Santa with me, and at least say that I actually exist.
well, don't tell that to the 7-year-olds in the world. That's what I was thinking of. Like, just kidding.
I exist, but I'm not bringing you presents.
Fair enough. This is my present for the year. Really, it is. So I want to dive in, and you know, first things first. And I really, honestly hate to start with a serious question out of the gate, but I know that my listeners are really dying to understand this and really dying to know this. Star Trek or Star Wars? Because Star Trek. I know you're a fan.
Star Trek.
Star Trek? All right. Next question. All right. We can now continue this interview. Now,
there's at least some premise of actual science going on in Star Trek. There's at least some thought that went into the physics, the chemistry, the biology, the reasoning, the logic. There's some thread through every episode, and I've yet to find any such corresponding threads in Star Wars. So to me, Star Wars is, you know, yes, it's a fight between good and evil that happens to take place in space, not because it actually needed to be there.
Fair enough. And that's a great answer, too. And obviously, I'm a fan of Star Trek, so you had the right answer on that one as well. But that's good to know. That's good to know. Thank you. I think one of those interesting things that you mentioned in your lecture in Chicago, and it's something that I think we take for granted, which is essentially in the vein of my first question, is that you mentioned that because of Albert Einstein's just amazing work, we've been able to create, by virtue of that, basically standing on his shoulders, more future Nobel Prize-winning innovations like lasers. And, you know, recently, you know, we discovered the Higgs boson in the last, I believe, decade or so. And so basically, science and technology, from what I understand, builds upon itself to improve over time. And lately, obviously, with the microprocessor, we've been accelerating that growth vastly. So my question to you is, are there any limitations here, if any? Like, what could stunt the growth or impede our progress as humanity just continues to innovate? And I'm very curious to know if you think there is a limit to, you know, to what we can achieve.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the one who you look back on and say, oh, look how stupid he was. He thought we were at the limits of our understanding. I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to say that there are limits. What I will say is that, yes, there are limits to microcircuitry, all right? If you have electrical pathways that are sufficiently small and near each other, because the miniaturization of electronics is an important feature of what it is to make them fast, something that eluded any futurist from the 1960s, such as the concept of HAL in the movie 2001, the idea was, okay, if powerful computers are big, then really powerful computers are even bigger, right? So there's Hal occupying this whole section of the ship with his microprocessor. And it's like, no, that's not how you make a computer fast, because the travel time of electrical circuitry through it can actually significantly impede calculations that happen at a very rapid rate. So the point is, if you miniaturize it too much, what happens is the quantum wavelength of the electrons in the circuit they end up sharing a quantum state with electrons in an adjacent circuit. And you can't have that. They need to be completely insulated from each other. So there's a physical limit to how small you can make this before the entire microcircuitry gets completely scrambled by quantum coherence. And so a side branch of that is just quantum computing, where, you know, you have bits. Your audience probably is familiar with this. Your bits, and all of computing is binary, zeros and ones.
Right.
So the quantum computer exploits the fact that in quantum physics, you don't have that level of certain information about anything, that there's a probability that an entity is one value or another. And so it's called the superposition. So you can have the superposition of a bit having the value of zero or having the value of one. And that superposition means it can be any value in between,
right?
Okay? Statistically, any value in between. And so we call those qubits, right? Q-U-B-I-T-S. So quantum computing exploits the very real quantum nature of the universe in the circuitry itself. So that would be an important leap over the computing that we're doing now. But what we don't know is, might something be discovered in this century or the next that's a whole entire new other thing that exploits a new feature of the natural universe? I'm making this up, but maybe dark matter and dark energy, once we know what it is, that will empower us to do a whole other thing and open a whole other economy. In the same way quantum physics, discovered a century ago, opened the entire world of the information technology universe. There's no creation, storage, and retrieval of information, digital information, without the quantum that front and center in how and why that works. So I'm not given reason to presume somehow we're at the end of things. And given that dark matter and dark energy are 95% of all that is driving this universe, and we don't know what's causing it, it really doesn't sound like we're on top of the situation. So I'm going with, yeah, there's probably more to come.
Fair enough. And I would agree with you. I mean, I believe we will continue to progress as humans. I mean, that's just in our nature. We want to explore, whatever exploration means, you know, to whoever's doing the exploring. But in the vein of my last question, one of the things that I'm actually driving at, because it's actually part of my day job, is that we've really seen a rise of anti-science and anti-education in the past few years. We have a huge amount of misinformation and disinformation that appears to be rampant online. So now we have to contend with, let's say, progress or anti-progress in things like vaccines. We have vaccine hesitancy. We see baseless conspiracy theories. Even the term research seems to be co-opted by certain people. And studies are showing that people are trusting, like, a Facebook friend posting whatever they're posting more than the due diligence that science analysis or scientific analysis is paying to verify information and putting it out in the public sphere. So in that sense, what do you think is the biggest issue we have in that context?
So let me be a mild devil's advocate here and suggest that maybe anti-science is not on a rise or at an all-time high. It may be, but let me just offer another explanation here. It could be that such people were always out there. And now with social media and the internet, they can find each other and they can band together. And so they can have a louder collective voice than any one of them could have had as individuals. But I don't know if there are more, if you're counting absolute numbers today, than in the past, or more as a fraction of the public. That's my first comment. Second, it's clear that if you have a full-grown adult who thinks Earth is flat, that's evidence of, I think, two things in this world. One, that we live in a country that protects free speech. So there you go. And another, that we have a failure in the educational pipeline, where people don't really know or understand what science is and how and why it works. So science, I think, has been taught, oh, here's a textbook, learn this, you get tested on it, and we're done. And nowhere is there the lingering understanding that science is a way of querying nature with methods and tools exquisitely tuned to prevent you from thinking something is true that is not, or from thinking something that is not true that is. And absent that training, you are susceptible to all manner of forces out there, leaving you to think that practically anything can be true just because it feels good to think so. Mm. So I don't know if these people have to age out and the next generation with a curriculum that does right by science takes over. I do know that the next generation is very climate change woke, and that means they're listening to the scientists. They have only known life with a smartphone, and they know intuitively that a smartphone is enabled by countless thousands of science and engineering marvels that enable them to do everything they can. And I have to remind my daughter, for example, that, oh, by the way, you know, your smartphone is also a telephone. We can call each other.
Right.
Have you considered that?
What?
What a concept.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So I think it's quite a challenge, and I can ask it another way. If this landscape of science educators did not exist, and I'm a part of that landscape, as are you, maybe it would all be worse. So it's not that we're bad at our jobs, it's that we're not appreciating how much better things are for the work that we're doing. That's, of course, a self-serving comment, but to all of us who are out there in the blogosphere and you know, YouTubers and Instagrammers, there are a lot of science educators out there who are doing homespun, interesting science experiments that are intriguing and they have great personalities. And so I think you have to keep trying.
Yeah, no, and I would agree. I mean, and I would say of my own audience, those that are interested in the sciences and, you know, listening to people like you.
Pre-sorted for you, yes.
Yeah, you know, so it's a great audience to reach. But, you know, as I'm looking at this, though, I mean, I you're also sitting on a radio show that actually interviewed one of the leaders of the Flat Earth movement like a year and a half ago to talk specifically about, if social media didn't exist, you would still be like 12 people in a newsletter not finding each other. You know, and it was an interesting conversation to see them. And my fear always with this is that, you know, as they put a rather loud voice out there, they continue to attract people that are simply not reading in, or they've got a friend that says, oh, yeah, oh, this makes sense. And
again, this is a free country. We're not here to control your thoughts. So it's there are plenty of jobs for you in this world if you think Earth is flat. Okay. What you want to do is keep people like that away from becoming head of NASA, for example. That could be a major regressive force in civilization and in our culture. So I don't know if it's actually more, but it's no less of a challenge for educators who are out there to address this misthinking. People don't know what data are. They don't know what it means to be an expert. An expert is just whoever tells them something convincingly rather than looking at. By the way, advertisers know this, right? Advertisers don't just show data and say, here's why this car is better. It's better on all these tables and all these graphs. No, they get somebody, wow, that car is amazing. I was able to do everything I want. And you're hearing the person, the testimony, without regard to the person's expertise, what they know. Maybe they don't know anything about cars, but you don't care because it's another human being sharing their emotional reaction to something that you then define to be the new truth. And it's a shortcoming of our capacity, shortcoming of our interactions with others. Okay. It's why we invented science, to bypass that.
And I think that's a really good point. And in that vein, I actually have another question that is actually really similar, but it has to relate with science and actually what we just saw in Afghanistan with regime change. And the reason why I say this is I actually did my fourth TED Talk on that subject, on the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the privacy.
Fourth TED Talk?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love them. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They're fun. Yeah, literally last week. It'll be out shortly. And
well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Very important platform. Yes.
Yeah, I love it, and I think everybody should, you know, engage in it whatever way, whether you're listening or participating, whatever it is. I think it's a fantastic platform that's put out for the world, and I'm very happy I'm able to do those. But basically, I talked about the Taliban takeover as it spells problems for their very heavily data mined population, and I'm going to science with this. Trust me on this, because it seems like having an identity system outside of a government control would actually help quell the threat of having the information you post online be used against you by, let's say, a sudden regime change like the Taliban taking over. And I don't think they're going to be the only country to experience that as we see democracy under threat. And what do you see in this current political climate in the West as the biggest threat to the national scientific institutions that could possibly go through government change? What if, as you mentioned, you know, we have free speech in this country, what if suddenly we didn't? Like, what would the research that science is doing, would it purely be a weaponization of things, or would something else that we'd have to be concerned about as we are going through this? And a lot of people obviously are concerned for democracy in the United States, as well as, you know, Europe, as we're seeing authoritarians attempt to rise. So I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
A couple of things. I think we overcredit free speech for so many things that we enjoy as Americans that actually have nothing to do with free speech.
Okay.
So, for example, Russia beat us in practically every metric of space exploration until we landed on the moon. It's not a democracy. No, it's not. And they don't have free speech. Mm-hmm. And they're not free in the way that we valued here in the United States. Yet they were kicking our buttocks in technological advances. And so we like to think of free speech as something that promotes science and engineering, whereas our educational systems show up very low on international rankings of how well we do in our science and math. Basics coming through, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade. Not only that, China has the world's largest radio telescope right now. And ours just crumbled into dust, the Arecibo telescope. Look it up on YouTube. You can watch it collapse in real time. This was the largest telescope in the world for 60 years or so. And China now has it, so that aliens trying to talk to Earthlings, their first contact will be Chinese astrophysicists. Not only that, China has the record for the farthest distance between two quantum entangled particles, right? Oh, but they have human rights violations, and there's not really free speech, and there's authoritarian, and is it a dictator or is it a lead? How do you? So these systems are very different from us, yet it's not stopping their advances at all. England, with a monarchy, made all manner of advances in science and technology coming out of the 17th and into the 18th century. A lot of it was militaristically motivated, of course, as you had hinted, but or said explicitly. But so just because we have free speech is not alone the thing that makes this happen. What makes it happen is you need a system of government that cares about discovery, whatever is motivating them. And most of the time it's war, but it could also be economics. And it could be just because it's kind of cool, all right? Right. The kind of cool money funded the Hubble telescope, all right? That itself didn't have security value, although it was based on a previous model that did, all right? There were Hubble telescopes in orbit pointing down before the Hubble telescope that we know and love pointed up. Hmm. So now, that being said, let me make a difference. You need free exchange of scientific ideas. That's an aspect of free speech, right? But I don't think that's what people think of when they think of free speech. They think of you're out in the open and you want to say whatever you want. That's different from when I publish something, does everyone have access to it? Science cannot productively move forward without that kind of openness of what is discovered. And you could close it all off if it's secret or top secret security. You could do that, sure, but you won't get the benefit of others who might be working on the same thing that could advance your results even faster or further. So science isn't free and open exchange of ideas. That's how it works. If you go back 1,000 years to the Middle East, Baghdad, right in the center of the golden age of Islam, you can say, well, what made that period in location and time so special? Well, Baghdad was a major trading center. And so Christians and Muslims and Jews and atheists, although I don't know how, there might have been a different word for the non-believer back then. But anyway, everyone moved through those places, and there was a big and beautiful library there. So it became a place where you'd exchange ideas, you would contest ideas. And if you do that in a way without killing each other, every idea you have, if someone thought about it more than you, it rapidly advances. And faster than if you're sitting at home alone in your armchair. And so great advances in engineering, astronomy, medicine, and especially mathematics rose up out of that period. Point is, you can't just cite, we are humans, it's in our DNA to explore, as a permanent and eternal reality among humans, because the countries that actually do it, first, it's not all countries, it's only a very select subset, and not all countries do it for all of time. And so you really have to look at the cultural, political constructs of those times and places to see what it was that was valued by the leaders, by the electorate, or whoever was in charge of running the place. Mm-hmm. And was exploration and discovery a fundamental part of their portfolio? Because if it wasn't, they would then be dancing to the tunes played by others, or just simply regressing back into the cave, because that's where you go if you stop advancing.
Right. Well, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, and even in your book, Accessory to War, which I thought was just really interesting, you know, you mentioned that both Archimedes and Leonardo would have basically worked for their departments of defense, right? When the telescope came about, it was an immediate instrument of war. And so there is, I think, in one aspect, as I was talking about, the militarization of that. But yes, if you have the time, the money, the energy, and the effort, and a government that really says, yeah, we want to do this, we want to get to the moon in a decade, you know, you can do it. You just have to have the effort for that. And I think that's just...
Yeah, but let me just be clear. When we said, let's go to the moon in the decade, we had just witnessed the Soviet Union just beat us at get to space first. So this was a reactive posture that we took, not a proactive posture.
Right.
I have no doubt that if Russia were not threatening us, the godless commies, right? If they weren't threatening us, that we wouldn't have gone anywhere. We're not that organized. We're not that coherent in our responses to do things just because some fraction of the country wants to do it. But when everybody feels threatened, your way of life and all the rest, which is how communism was portrayed as the great threat to democracy and to freedom and to peace-loving nations around the world, then we responded. So all the front-end rhetoric, we'll do it not because it's easy, but because it's hard, no task will be so, and it was stirring rhetoric. But you part the curtains, and behind there is, we're at war, Congress, please write the checks. Okay, because we need this in order to maintain our self-image that we are better than they are at everything.
Right.
You need that as the backdrop. It's not just the speech. The whole landscape has to support it. And like I said, in some other research I'd done, appeared in a different volume, in the Space Chronicles book, it's either war or money. These are the two big drivers of doing very expensive things. The urge to explore and discover, I've never seen that win out over anything. It typically piggybacks the other exercises.
Right. Well, and even the discovery of America was for wealth.
Yeah, exactly. It was a shorter route to the Far East.
Exactly.
Columbus is looking for India, and he calls the new people he meets Indians. Right. Yeah.
That's his thing.
If it weren't so tragic, it would be completely hilarious that this is how history played out, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The motivation, this was not, Columbus did that before the Dutch East India Trading Company went around and made a buck, by the way. Because they would then learn where the trade winds, where the hostiles, where the friendlies, is there food there, what is there a marketplace. So the governments did things for hegemonistic reasons, geopolitical reasons. And so let's be honest with ourselves about that. That's why no one's going to Mars unless we feel threatened by someone else who is.
Right. And you mentioned that as well, you know, in your lecture in Chicago, which I thought was great. And just looking at the time, and I wish I had 3 hours with you, but I don't. I'd like to talk about your latest book, A Brief Welcome to the Universe, pocket size edition. And, you know, can you explain to my audience all about that? Because, I mean, you're writing.
Yeah. So I have two co-authors on it, Michael Strauss and J. Richard Gott III. The three of us co-taught an introductory astrophysics class at Princeton University back when I was on the faculty there. And we really didn't want to teach the class because we had other things we wanted to do, but the class had to be taught. So we stapled ourselves together, and because then we'd only have to teach a third of the class. So it was part laziness, but also part we taught the subjects that we were most enthusiastic about. Well, that's how we divided the universe. But we also did another thing. Instead of following a traditional curriculum, we just picked the coolest stuff we can think of in the universe and put that in the course. And then we were invited to write a textbook, which we did, but it was still kind of very conversational and very, here's cool, here's another cool thing, I'll tell you that. And this one intrigued me, I'll tell you that. All right, and that was, we wrote the textbook. And by the way, it has math in it, right? But then the publisher, Princeton Press, said, maybe this could, we can get a pocket size version of this. So here we have a course that we taught where we taught only our favorite stuff. And that's what ended up in the textbook. And now we cherry picked the textbook to put what's in the pocket sized edition. And so this, this is intensely, the book is, it has a level of enthusiastic intensity that may be rare in science books, just because it's the stuff we love the most. And you are gonna benefit from that if you check it out. So that's what it just came out just this month.
Yeah, no, and I think that's great. And I know you always have stuff that's going on, and your writing is just absolutely fantastic. For those of my listeners or viewers that haven't read any of your books, I highly recommend picking them up, you know, including the new ones. They're really approachable. And I think, honestly, that's one of those things that I just absolutely love about you when I'm listening to you or, you know, listening to Star Talk or, you know, whatever it is. I really do believe that when it comes to bringing science awareness to the general public, I'm not kidding. I think you are going to be the shoulders that others will stand on in the future. You are priming, I think, science.
Why my shoulders are kind of droopy lately?
Yeah, a little bit. But Neil, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for joining me today. And if anybody wants to follow you or you know, connect with you in some way, shape, or form on social media, what's the best way they can do that?
Yeah, it's all Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, at Neil deGrasse Tyson, D-E-G-R-A-S-S-E, the silent E, except on Twitter, where back in the birth of Twitter, you only had 140 characters. And I said, I'm not blowing a whole 8 characters on my middle name here, or however many characters, E-G-R-A-S-S-E, 7 characters. So it's Neil Tyson, at Neil Tyson on Twitter, where most of my communication with the public occurs when I'm not otherwise in the Chicago theater.
Right. And thank you. I knew we were the first on your tour, so I was very proud of that fact. But thank you again, and this has just absolutely been great. Thank you.
You got it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show with Nick Espinoza. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg. Her email is ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Nick Espinoza here in Chicago. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on Sprouts.
Welcome to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Today we look at a new musical, a notable Bardot film, and a new Criterion release of a cult favorite. First up is Kurt Conroyd to talk with us about Steven Spielberg's version of West Side Story. It's Kurt Conroyd. I'm talking with you. We're going to talk about West Side Story. Kurt is an actor and acting coach with time spent with the Steppenwolf troupe and a lot of acting experience in Chicago. We're going to talk about West Side Story because it's such a famous movie and Broadway musical. Probably people come to it with a lot of expectations. What were some of the things going through your mind before you walked into the theater?
I think it's such a huge, iconic game changer of a musical. And I think people view this musical as almost a religious or, you know, really fundamental experience growing up. There's so many people that go, oh,